Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So this day, as I said, Workers' Memorial Day, where we remember those who have fallen, our co-workers who have fallen over the years, remember who they were, their families, and then we pledge to make sure that the conditions in the future are such that we don't lose any more. Or as the old Mother Jones frame goes, mourn the dead, but fight like hell for the living. And here to share some thoughts on how we fight like hell for the living, I've asked Jimmy Williams to come talk with us. Jimmy's the General Vice President at Large for the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Jimmy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
So, you know, this day, we a special day for working people, where we remember those who, got killed on the job. And, you know, I think back to the folks that I know, and I talked about one guy earlier, and just horribly tragic and sad and really harmful to the families, you know, especially the kids who, you know, they lost their father, as I remember. And it's just tragic.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think Workers' Memorial Day, at least in the last 2 years, has taken on such a different meaning in this time with COVID and the crisis that we're faced with the pandemic. And, you know, it's always good to take a pause and remember. I think, you know, we became a little numb over the last, you know, year and a half or so to the sheer volume of people that have been affected by the pandemic, and the very nature of, like, their workplaces have been, you know, places where the virus has been spreading. I know in our union, very early in the pandemic, we had two members pass that worked at the same place at the New York City Housing Authority, and were going to work early in the pandemic, and they both contracted COVID, clearly on the job site, very hard to prove that, but and perished. And there's countless numbers of stories of all the frontline workers in healthcare, construction, you know, grocery store workers, people that have worked through the pandemic and have suffered loss.
The folks that we called essential, the people that we called frontline heroes, those are the people you're talking about, right?
Absolutely.
And this becomes one of those moments where you have to take a step back. And because one of the things I hear a lot from people go, well, you know, we don't need unions anymore, Jimmy, because, yeah, that's something that happened a long time ago. Because, unfortunately, years ago, we were losing 100,000 workers a year. The numbers were staggering. And because unions did their job, because we pushed for sane, rational regulation and government action, and the two of them together brought those numbers down, it's not something that happens as often as it used to, but I argue it happens more than it should.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about, like, Workers' Memorial Day, you know, it was 1970 that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration was formed. 1970. Yeah. I mean, think of the countless millions of workers in the United States working in the mines, working in construction, working in high-risk jobs before the passage of the act that were just, you know, treated like they were meaningless. And, you know, I think far too often people forget the struggle and then also take advantage or take for granted the gains. And, you know, Workers' Memorial Day is a great day to look back on our history and recalibrate our fights for the future, because we're going to have to do something with infectious disease. You know, we were caught flat-footed with COVID. Our workplaces weren't safe. No. And we do need to push hard to make sure that OSHA has a standard for infectious diseases going forward, because this is going to be here for and with us forever.
You're absolutely right. And what we need to do also is we need to rebuild OSHA. We need to refund it. We need to bring in more inspectors. During the last term, during the last president's term, OSHA inspectors had fallen to the lowest number in its history. The number I saw, it would take, I think, like 160 years for the current level of OSHA inspectors to inspect every workplace in the country. And you go 160 years to get to every one of them. And as you've said, with infectious diseases, you now can't narrow them out of which might be dangerous and which might not be. With infectious diseases, they all are. So this is something we really need to address.
No, that's for sure. You know, thankfully, we have an administration that's going to invest and rebuild and, you know, do the things necessary to support the government agencies that need the most help, you know, and that's a good thing. But we do have to push for legislation as well. And we have to make sure that any new and incoming administrations don't have the ability to gut the government agencies that are there to protect the American workforce.
Right. Now, during the heart of the pandemic, we'd had a number of union leaders come on and talk about the work that they were doing to help keep their members safe. And overwhelmingly, you look at, especially in the food production industry, I had, a Teamster local come on and talk about how right at the beginning of the pandemic, they had a couple of people get it. They immediately were in a very proactive way, did all of the things to do to keep their members safe and didn't lose anybody. We're just 15 miles down the road. You had the Tyson plant that lost a whole bunch of people and half the place was infected. It was a nightmare. And for me, this goes back to another reason why we need strong unions, why workers need to have that voice on the job, and why, looking at what happened at Amazon, why we need comprehensive labor law reform. And, the PRO Act to me is not perfect. I still say we need to repeal Taft-Hartley entirely and go back to the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act. But the PRO Act is a step in the right direction. Do you see any way of us getting there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's front and center, right? And we still have work to do. We have three United States senators in the Democratic caucus that still needs to be moved. But the president of the United States has made it a priority. And thank God. For the first time in our generation, or at least in my lifetime, a sitting president has made strengthening unions a priority, even created and announced a task force this week within the White House of his key advisors, including Marty Walsh and including the Vice President of the United States. And it's not just something that was put together to appease unions like has been done in the past. I mean, it's legitimate. It's going to be a fight. It's going to be a struggle for sure. The president also put forth the American Families Plan this week. And these are all positive things for the American family and the American workforce. But it's always going to be a fight and it's going to be a struggle. Nothing's ever easy. Nothing's ever won easy. And we still got work to do to push portions of the PRO Act across the finish line. Will we be able to get through without any Republican support? Probably not. A clean version of the PRO Act. However, if we fight and we push and we demand, we could maybe remove the filibuster and we could definitely get pieces through reconciliation that can help the American workers and the American labor movement.
No, it's something we definitely need. And the reason I bring this up on Workers' Memorial Day is look, we don't know what the future holds. We've learned lessons from this pandemic. We've learned the lessons of what an ineffective government has done. We've learned the penalties that working people, we've given them nice names, essential worker, frontline hero, even threw them a couple of pennies with the praise, and then immediately clawed it back. I want to make sure that in the future, we're much more proactive in protecting our coworkers and ourselves. The life you might save might be your own. So for me, this day, this moment is about remembering those who have passed, mourning their passing, promising to help their families, but also promising to make sure we don't allow this to happen again in the future.
Yeah, and I think of the countless, thousands of non-union workers that don't have the protections of a labor union on a day like today. Because we mourn for our membership, but the most vulnerable are those workers that are working in high-risk jobs without the benefit of a labor union. And that's where we need support. That's where we need things like the PRO Act, but we also need an active federal government to clean up those most vulnerable workers that are out there. Our unions do provide the highest level of health and safety training. We do have all of the programs needed to support our membership through hard times like this pandemic and others. But I just think about the countless, millions of American workers that don't have the benefit of a union.
I'm glad you brought that up because, unions get painted a lot of times as narrow self-interest. Oh, you care about your members. And it's true. Unions do care about their members. They want their members to get better wages, hours, conditions. There's no shying away from that. But overall, unions do fight for the betterment of all workers in this country. And I'll fight anybody anywhere to prove that to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I'll bring up an example within our industry. Way back when, lead-based paint was the way that paint was manufactured and made in this country, and it was a poisonous thing for painters, whether they were in a union or not in a union. And 25% of all the deaths related to lead poisoning was from the painting industry, and we had to fight back then. To have lead-based paint removed. And, we're still dealing with that crisis today with people that live in homes that were constructed years and years ago that still have lead-based paint in their systems. And, you know, it's a health risk, but unions fought for everybody when they fought for that, just like the mine workers and the mine health and safety, you know, reforms that were won. That's what unions do. They don't do that just for their membership.
For me, when conditions rise, they rise for everyone. And unions have been the driver in that. Now, you brought up a moment ago that the Biden administration has put together this task force headed up by Marty Walsh, the labor secretary, and Kamala Harris, the vice president, the task force on worker organizing and empowerment. How do you see that being used and playing out for average everyday working people? Because for me, this is the first time in my lifetime that my government has said that we are not only going to give you the lip service that you have the right, but we're actually going to promote your right and encourage your right. To me, that's a monumental moment.
Yeah, and I think it's twofold, right? Look, if we can't get the PRO Act passed, we have to organize 2022 in the midterm cycle to build a bigger majority. And we have to be bringing our organizing stories to that task force. We have to be bringing the issues to light, and having a voice that can be heard is an exciting thing for the labor movement, but it's incumbent upon us to bring our stories, to bring, you know, the cases of workers that are misclassified in the construction industry forward so that Secretary Walsh and the Vice President of the United States can hear and see and put a face on the real issues that the American workers faced with. I also think there's a big side of this too, that, you know, the Supreme Court ruled, you know, terribly against us for public employees back with the Janus decision. And I know the federal government is going to try to do everything they can to strengthen federal employees' rights too, and promote collective bargaining in the public sector, which is really, really important as well.
It's something we most certainly desperately need. Now, last line of questioning I want to get to you with, because there's, I know you guys have been on the front of immigrant rights and pushing for dignity and respect for all folks. And one of the things, being in the workplace, the reason that I'm in favor of immigrant rights is because I don't believe we can afford to have people in the shadows. I don't think we can afford to have exploitable, disposable people working among us. So I want them out of the shadows. I want them to have protections, and I want them to be able to blow the whistle on bad employers. You guys are in the middle of that mix, and you're calling on the Biden administration to protect those immigrant wage theft whistleblowers.
Yeah, we have been really at the forefront of the immigration battle, and things got stalled under Trump because there was just not going to be any sort of action. But, some of this stuff is important, and being able to create things like deferred action for workers that speak out against their employers so that they can be whistleblowers is important. And having the Department of Labor working closely with the Department of Homeland Security so that it's not one of these where they point to the other and say, well, there's nothing I can do. Well, no, there is. And having that interagency work is really important so that workers can come forward. On Worker Memorial Day, I think it's important to recognize the contribution that immigrant workforce has brought to our country. And quite frankly and sadly, it's the most easily exploitable workforce and the ones that are working in the most danger, at least in our industry.
Right.
And so we've been extremely, vocal and supportive of saying early in this administration, let's give those workers their voice. Let's have them step forward outside the shadows, get deferred action, not be afraid to speak up, because it's the employers who are abusing them.
No, you're absolutely right. And look, we want the highest standards possible, the best wages, the best working conditions. And when you have people who are exploitable, it tears that down, and we can't have that. I believe we need to pull people out of the shadows, give them rights on the job, and make conditions better for all of us. Because sadly, and I've worked with a number of immigrant rights folks who have told just horror stories about the kind of work that they do. In fact, there was one point where I was going to go down and pick tobacco in North Carolina. We couldn't arrange it for a whole bunch of reasons. But I was going to go down and spend a week with these folks. But the horror stories of the conditions and being covered with these covers and pesticides and just horrible stuff that you or I would never allow to have happen are happening to these people simply because they're exploitable.
Rick, if anybody's listening and wants to learn more on the subject, go to our Twitter account, go to GoIUPAT, and watch some of the videos that we put out this week around worker misclassification and what the immigrant workforce in the construction industry is up against. Some of it's gut-wrenching, and some of it will definitely motivate you to maybe change your line of thinking when it comes to how we treat immigrant workers.
No, you guys have done a fantastic job. I mean, you guys have been on the forefront of drawing attention to this. So the question that comes into it, because, you know, your membership has been painted as somewhere, you know, in the middle, you know, divided, you know, how do you get, you know, how do we get people on board with this? Because immigration is one of those hot button issues. There are folks who think we shouldn't allow people in, slam the door, throw the ladder down. How do you bridge that gap?
You certainly don't run from it. And you know, I've seen unions that have run from it, and I think it doesn't help their agenda. You have to take the issue to the membership. You have to explain to the membership that the enemy is not the worker, that the enemy is the employers. It is the system above the worker. And, you know, our membership is no different than any other membership within the construction industry. Yeah, they are torn on it because they want someone to blame. Donald Trump played off of that. And thankfully, you know, those days are over for him. But the feelings still exist inside of our membership. And we just don't run from it. It's continuous education. It's constant communication. And, you know, I do have hope that the younger workforce in this country doesn't have those same types of beliefs. And if we can continue to promote and become more diverse as a union, then we can get past some of those divide issues that happen. And we believe that.
Yeah, you guys do really good stuff. And I do hope folks will check out your Twitter account. We'll get links out so folks can take a look at that. Also, the website, iupat.org. We'll get links out so folks can take a look at that. Jimmy, keep up the great work. I love having you on the program. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Rick.
I'd love to hear your stories on this Workers' Memorial Day. Did you lose someone on the job? So shoot me an email, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'd like to hear your story. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 7034, establishing the Works Progress Administration. The WPA employed millions in public works projects during the Great Depression. As many as 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA at some point between the years 1935 and 1943. At its height, over 3 million Americans were working WPA jobs. These jobs included the construction of roads, bridges, utilities, and parks. It also meant the construction of new schools, libraries, public buildings, and housing. Many WPA jobs also employed musicians, artists, and writers in literature and art projects. The program's goals were to provide one job to every household suffering long-term unemployment. Some of the most famous projects included LaGuardia Airport in New York City, Blue Ridge Parkway, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Artists like Jacob Lawrence and Mark Rothko were employed at the Federal Arts Project. Historian Eric Loomis notes that the Federal Writers Project began the field of oral histories with extensive interviews of surviving ex-slaves. The WPA also bolstered federal funding for school lunches. The program was initially criticized for underemployment of African Americans who suffered disproportionately during the Depression. But many black leaders later hailed the WPA as providing job opportunities to blacks and keeping race discrimination to a minimum, at least in the North. The right attacked the program as a hotbed for communists and a scheme to build Democratic Party patronage. By 1940, WPA projects shifted towards war preparation and defense-related projects. When the country reached full employment in 1942, the WPA ceased to exist by July of 1943.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I really like that guy. If we had more representatives like Andy Levin in Congress, And maybe I should put it this way. If we had more people like Andy Levin in the Senate, which is where we need them, because everything that every good idea seems to go to die in the Senate. And I fear the PRO Act is one of those things, just like the $15 an hour minimum wage, that gets chucked out to make one of the conservative Democrats happy. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, you know, how big it is that the PRO Act was included in this infrastructure bill and why we need to do, as Andy Levin said, get in the streets, make the calls, get active around it. I've asked our good friend Sarah Nelson to come talk with us. Sarah is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm always happy to be on the Rick Smith Show.
And it's always great to have you. I've been saying I want this PRO Act included in the infrastructure bill, and Joe Biden listened.
It's incredible. It's like you've got a direct line there, Rick. Direct line.
Direct line. Because, look, I asked him to fire Peter Robb day one, and he did it.
Yeah. Hey, keep making asks. Keep making demands. We need you making demands. No, and seriously, I do want to just note that for anybody listening, we got to make demands on everyone. We have to be realistic. So there's two different things going on here when we talk about things going to die in the Senate and not counting on Republicans, all that. We have to be realistic about what we have seen up till now. And we have to have Democrats be willing to act without Republicans. But I don't want people out there listening to be confused about what our job is. We don't give up on anyone. We put the pressure on everyone. We put the screws to everyone. Because if we write off Mitch McConnell, let's take anyone else in his caucus, we are essentially saying that we don't care about the workers in that state or in a congressional district if it's a Republican in the House. And that's just not true. We're going to stand up for everybody. So we're going to put the pressure on everyone. And I think that that is what is so great about what's happening in Bessemer, actually, is that, you know, we have been raising the narrative about why we need workers' rights. And I have to tell you, you know, of course we need the PRO Act. It's way better than EFCA. EFCA was all about, you know, trying to get more membership. The PRO Act is all about giving power to working people and restoring the full right to strike, making sure that you can get to those first contracts, getting rid of right to work for less laws. And really putting power back in the hands of working people. But, you know, most people don't even know what a union is. When I say, I'll see you at the table, they're like, is there going to be turkey there? I don't know what that means. They don't know what union means. They don't know what collective bargaining means. We have to do a good job of helping the public understand what it means. But I'll tell you what, they can understand it when they start to hear about the stories from the Amazon warehouse and not even being able to go to the bathroom or getting a ding if you're not touching a box soon enough and having more of a relationship with an app than any human being. Hiring $3,500 a day consultants to try to interfere with your rights. You know, it's exactly like the voter suppression efforts going on around the country. The two are exactly the same. This is about not wanting to give any power to individuals, to individual people, to the working people in this country. And so people are seeing that now. And so the PRO Act is actually coming alive for people. This isn't just some academic exercise about whether or not we're going to, you know, sign enough cards for something. This is about actually interfering with the right of people to stand up and say, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm not going to take this crap anymore. And by the way, $15 an hour is not enough to live in Birmingham or in Bessemer. And it's not enough for the job that I'm doing, standing on my feet all day long for 10 and 12 hour shifts where you're yelling at me if I don't touch a box every 8 seconds. So, you know, this is really bringing it to life for people. And I think that's why the PRO Act is moving. And then I got to say, it's smart of the president to put the PRO Act in this infrastructure bill. And, you know, whether or not it actually gets through that way, Rick, what we're doing is we are raising the stakes here.
We're educating.
We are defining the problem. Absolutely. Defining the problem that we have today with the inadequate, watered down, horseshit labor law that exists today in this country and needs to be fixed if we're actually serious about living in the land of the free.
You're right. One of the things, and I talk to new members all the time, one of the things that I always talk about is this sense of empowerment. Yeah, the wages are better. The health care is better. The retirement security is better. All of that's better. It's the empowerment. And when I was driving a truck all those years, I tell my truck driving friends, I went out, the brakes were out of alignment. It didn't move until it was fixed. If the lights weren't working, didn't move till it was fixed. If there was something wrong mechanically with that truck, it did not move until it was fixed. I was empowered to do that. And yeah. I talked to a lot of non-union drivers. They're shocked by that because they're told, take it or go home. And to me, it's that empowerment that you get from having a contract that says, this is what it is, and this is how you can defend yourself, and having a grievance procedure to help protect yourself.
Yep. You know, on the safety items, we have whistleblower protections that exist. That exists because unions fought for that. But do you think a worker actually has whistleblower protections in their job if they don't have a union to back them in using those whistleblower protections? No, of course not. So I just also want to give a shout out to the flight attendants at Envoy Air who got a tentative agreement today in the middle of coronavirus. I want to note that this is an example of what it means to have a union in the middle of a crisis. Not only did our union make sure that this crisis didn't get put on our backs because we made demands on what the relief package was going to look like, and we got those demands met even under a Trump-McConnell regime because we had enough power with 80% of the aviation workers in a union. We had enough power to do what most people would say was impossible. But beyond that, so I said, listen, we got to set the narrative that workers are not going to pay for this crisis because, you know, the corporate elite will never let a good crisis go to waste.
Absolutely. They'll fill their coffers. You know that.
Absolutely. And so we set that tone. We said, no, you know, we're not going to pay for this. But today I'm so happy that we got this tentative agreement at Envoy because not only are we saying we're not going to pay for this, flight attendants at Envoy Air now are going to get to vote on improvements in the middle of this pandemic still. We're getting improvements, and they should get improvements. I'm not saying that that's an incredible thing. But if you look at what's happening across the country, what worker is actually getting a pay raise right now? And it's only where you see unions that that's happening.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's only the ones that people have contracts. And I always point out that every CEO in the country has a contract. If the boss has got one, you should have one too. But this goes back to the beginning, the war between capital and labor. You know, the boss is never going to be your friend. I say this all the time. These companies that we have contracts with, they're good companies. They're nice. They work with us. We do all that stuff. They're not benevolent. They didn't give you this stuff out of the goodness of their heart because they think you're wonderful. They gave it to you because you fought for it, demanded it, and generations before you did that, which is why I think it's important to remember our history, but also to pull people in to, as you pointed out, be much more militant.
Absolutely. I got to tell you, you know, I'm talking about the 50-year anniversary of the book Strike by Jeremy Brecker. And I have a piece in the beginning here that I wrote to start off the 50th anniversary, along with Kim Kelly, who also wrote a piece that I just read again today. It's really fantastic. But we are talking about this on Tuesday. And what this book is really about is saying we have to know our history as working people because it's not taught in the schools. Because who is deciding what's in the curriculum in our schools? You know, it's not people who want us to know what the kind of power that working people have when we come together.
Right.
And so, you know, we it's really on us to help people understand the kind of power that we have and what our history is and what we have today because of what people fought for and died to get and what is at risk of being taken away if we don't organize like they did in the 1930s and 40s.
You're absolutely right. I tell new members all the time, you don't take for granted what you have today because you may give it away. People fought for this. People bled and died for it. And I look at the National Master Freight Agreement, which I worked under most of my life. I actually knew people who had their heads split open on picket lines fighting to get the things that we take for granted. You're absolutely right. But on the labor history part of it, you know, it's part of the reason that we do labor history in too. It's one of those things that I thought, you know, years ago we wanted to get little tidbits out to remind people that, hey, on this day, something happened where a worker struggled and, you know, either they won or they lost, but they still put up a fight. Because at the end of the day, you still got to ball up your digits and get in there and take a couple of punches, which is why I've always been such a fan of yours, because you're someone who, I'll be honest, I wouldn't want to meet you in an alley.
You know, Neil Cavuto said the same thing to me a couple weeks ago. But
so there you go. Look at that. I didn't mean to be anywhere near him, but I guess... I guess you should take that to heart.
Yeah, no, I took that as a badge of honor. So, listen, we've got to be fighting. Mother Jones said, you will fight and lose, fight and win, but you must fight. And when people know that you're fighting for them, they're going to come along with you and we're going to build power. A lot of people think that power is a limited resource, but the truth is that every time we act on our power, we actually increase it exponentially because other people see the results of that and they want to be a part of it and they're empowered by it. And once you get a taste of that, you won't settle for a bad deal and you won't stand by while someone else gets screwed either. And that's the whole idea behind union. And once people really get that feeling of solidarity and how powerful that is and how much it means in their hearts, this is usually what people are searching for in their whole lives and searching for it. And we have the answers for them in unions. So it's our responsibility. You know, a lot of times I say I need a union for my union because you don't really get vacations when you are union activists. But that's okay because the kind of fulfillment and energy and inspiration and rejuvenation that you get from being a part of helping people find their own power and make a difference in their lives, in their family lives, in their communities is better than any pina colada on the beach. And so, this is something that it was amazing to go down to Bessemer and talk with the workers there and talk with them about how their lives and their mission in life has changed in the course of a couple months because they've seen the way that they can work themselves to empower other people. And there's just nothing like it. And I have to tell you, I think they're going to win. I think we're going to have the results tomorrow. But if we don't win this vote, this is not over because there is majority support in that warehouse. The only reason that the workers may not win on that vote tomorrow is because Amazon had all the money and all the control in the world to be able to even, you know, thumb their nose at the National Mediation Board and put a mailbox with a tent around it saying, vote here. All of that stuff, by the way, would get fixed under the PRO Act because you don't wait until the end of the process. Amazon thinks they can just wait out the workers and demoralize them and hopefully eke out a win for the company and then have the workers either leave because it's such awful conditions that actually the turnover rate is 100% in a year. And so they're hoping that if they do all these illegal things and get slapped on the hand afterwards, it's not going to matter because they'll just demoralize everybody and make the union drive go away. That's not going to happen. So whether those workers win in the vote tomorrow or not, they've already won because they have changed that whole community. And that community is going to make sure that they hold Amazon accountable. And other people around this country now understand what the problem is, which is going to increase our power to get the PRO Act done. And it all moves forward in that way. You know, his statement was BS, and he doesn't really believe it. But even Rubio was moved to say that he supports the Amazon workers, okay? But this is a product of the labor movement being on the move. Conducting strikes, showing our power, organizing, raising the issue of essential workers, raising the issue of safety during coronavirus. And we have this shared experience now that we can build upon as well. And it is no small thing that we have a president who's willing to say, I'm a union guy, and actually back that up with actions like making the PRO Act central to his infrastructure plan. Because his infrastructure plan doesn't work unless workers have the power to get the value out of what they're creating for our whole country to use.
No, you're absolutely spot on. And real quick, since you brought up the infrastructure plan, and that's where we started, the aviation industry needs mass upgrades. Our airports are not great. I always go back to Thomas Friedman, who said he went from Beijing to LAX. It was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. I don't necessarily like being the Flintstones. So mass investment is what we need.
Yeah, I mean, the airport's not much better than our roads and bridges, and it all needs to be upgraded. And it is time. I think was it Andy Levin who was just saying it's like having a house and saying that you're not going to upkeep the stairs in the house. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, we've got to invest, and yeah, I'm super excited about the fact that airports are going to be modernized and infrastructure is going to be modernized there. And it's crazy actually that the United States would be so far behind the rest of the world at this point because we haven't made the kind of investments that are necessary.
Yeah. But here's the thing. It still has to get past the Senate. So what do you think the chances of an infrastructure plan getting through, given the fact that McConnell has come out and said, you're not getting anything from us?
So, first of all, oh my God, we have got to stop listening to McConnell. McConnell doesn't, he doesn't matter.
I didn't bring up the other guy who said that bill's cruel and heartless.
Yeah. So listen, I mean, he doesn't have any power if we put pressure on his caucus. And, you know, I saw this on sort of a smaller level. We got so much support for our payroll support program for a workers first package in the two previous relief bills in the CARES Act and in the emergency relief in December. We had so much bipartisan support for that because we were out there holding everyone accountable. We also pressured our corporations to be on the same page with us. So we brought that power of capital to the table as well. But I mean, that's what we can do here. And if you look at what's happening right now and the kind of actions that the GOP is taking, which is about having less participation, trying to not make people's lives better, but trying to make it harder for people to participate in our democracy, this is the time when we need to be pushing forward and getting things done. So people are seeing the effects of the American Rescue Plan. And I'll tell you, the day that I was in Bessemer was the day that stimulus checks were hitting. And every single person had a story about what that meant to them and how they had been just hanging on throughout the year and what a difference that made in their lives. And they were standing a little taller that day. I mean, I just think about the way that that empowered people, even in their own lives, that they could go home and tell their kids, hey, we're going to eat well tonight, right? And so when we get these results, people are more likely to understand why their vote matters, why their action mattered, and that's going to raise expectations. And we're already seeing that happen. And I just want to note that we're already seeing the White House shift on the filibuster, right? Politics have been shifting right in front of our very eyes because people are not giving up. They're continuing to demand better. And our expectations have been raised because of the campaign like Bernie Sanders ran, right? And so anyway, I just think, Rick, it's really, really important that we try to put our blinders on with McConnell and focus on the rest of his caucus, focus on the people in the House. Brian Fitzpatrick, for example, for the PRO Act. Hey, Brian, you're going to be for the PRO Act, but not for this infrastructure plan that's going to help your district as well? I don't think so. I think we're going to get Republicans on this, and we got to keep up the pressure on it. And the last thing we can do is say, oh, they're never gonna, because all that does is give them an excuse not to.
That's a good point. And we got to force them. We got to absolutely force them into it. You're right. Sarah, I appreciate the time. As always, great talk with you. Thank you for your passion. Thank you for your fight. Always great having you on.
Thanks, Rick. Okay. Good night.
Thanks so much, Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 7034, establishing the Works Progress Administration. The WPA employed millions in public works projects during the Great Depression. As many as 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA at some point between the years 1935 and 1943. At its height, over 3 million Americans were working WPA jobs. These jobs included the construction of roads, bridges, utilities, and parks. It also meant the construction of new schools, libraries, public buildings, and housing. Many WPA jobs also employed musicians, artists, and writers in literature and art projects. The program's goals were to provide one job to every household suffering long-term unemployment. Some of the most famous projects included LaGuardia Airport in New York City, Blue Ridge Parkway, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Artists like Jacob Lawrence and Mark Rothko were employed at the Federal Arts Project. Historian Eric Loomis notes that the Federal Writers Project began the field of oral histories with extensive interviews of surviving ex-slaves. The WPA also bolstered federal funding for school lunches. The program was initially criticized for underemployment of African Americans who suffered disproportionately during the Depression. But many black leaders later hailed the WPA as providing job opportunities to blacks and keeping race discrimination to a minimum, at least in the North. The right attacked the program as a hotbed for communists and a scheme to build Democratic Party patronage. By 1940, WPA projects shifted towards war preparation and defense-related projects. When the country reached full employment in 1942, the WPA ceased to exist by July of 1943.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So another shot to the Trump-era deregulation, let corporate America do whatever the hell they want. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals today, I guess it was yesterday, the Ninth Circuit shot down another Trump administration decision. They wanted to propose, and this has been going on for a while. In fact, I remember 2013 when we were doing our labor history tour. I remember my Teamster buddy in, I think it was Arkansas, who was saying, hey, this is coming. They want to put one guy in charge of driving the train. And you go, well, you know, it's just, you're just sitting there, you know, watching the tracks go by. No, what happens if someone has a heart attack? What happens if someone gets sick? What happens if? This is just more greed, more hooray for them and less for working people. And here to share some thoughts on this decision and why this is important, I have asked Greg Hines to come talk with us. Greg is the National Legislative Director for Smart TD. They're the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transport Workers. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, glad to be here.
So walk me through this decision. The court ruled, I guess it was yesterday now that I look at it, that they ruled that the Trump administration wanted to go to one person driving the train. This is going to open the door to leaving it at two. Am I getting that right?
Well, actually, they'd like to go to no people on the train is what they would like to do. And they're doing it step by step, trying to do it with one person. But the decision that was rendered by the court was, in my view, the correct decision. And what FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, tried to do was they tried to use something called a negative preemption. They tried to say that by them not issuing a rule on crew staffing, that would preempt all states from doing it either. So they were basically saying, we're not going to do anything about regulating how many crew members are on a train, and we're not going to allow any states to do it either. And so the court upheld our argument, and states' rights prevailed, and rail safety prevailed.
So now this is on. So let me figure out how this works now. So individual states can say yes, we're okay with one or no one in the train, and others can say no, we want two. Can anyone say three?
Well, actually, Washington's crew bill allows for three people in certain instances. The states' bills are pretty much the same, requiring a minimum of two person on all of them. There are some variant differences from state to state, but we have several states that have passed the law. And so a lot of those states were waiting on this decision to know whether they could implement the law and enforce it. And so this means that all of the states that passed two-person crew, they're now in effect.
Now, you know, like I said at the beginning, I remember in 2013, we did a cross-country labor history tour, and we ended up, I think, in Little Rock, if I'm not mistaken. And the guy we met there at the Teamsters Hall was saying, hey, make sure this is on your radar, because this is what the railroad companies are trying to do. They want to go down to one person. He said this is, and he went through a whole slew of why it would be a bad idea to have just one person in the train. Can you tell us what you think that those bad ideas would be to have one person handling the duties?
Well, you touched on some of it, you know, the safety of the crew member being up there by themselves, because trains run through the most rural parts of America. You're in the middle of nowhere. I worked as a train conductor. And so if something were to happen to you, you're by yourself in the middle of nowhere. You're just on your own. But how it really impacts the general public on a daily basis is with crossing accidents. We have thousands of crossing accidents every year. We have 400 to 500 fatalities in crossing accidents every year. So when you think about the public safety aspect of it, if a train hits a vehicle in a crossing, it takes that train a long time to stop. You know, some trains could take a mile to stop. So by the time they're stopped, they're blocking the crossing. If you have one person on that train, you don't have anybody to go back to see what happened, see how bad the damages are. When I've worked in these situations where we hit a car on a crossing, the first thing the conductor does is get off the train to go back to assess the damage, relay that to the engineer who's on the radio with emergency services to dispatch what they need, how serious it is, whether it's serious or not. And if there was only one person on that train, when you hit a car in the crossing, that engineer can't abandon his train. He would have to secure it before he could get off of it, which would take at least 45 minutes. So what he'd have to do is call the railroad, and they'd have to send somebody out there. And anybody who's been involved in any kind of traffic accident, you know that seconds count. So if you have to wait an hour for somebody even to come out there to assess what's going on there, you have a real problem. Not to mention that when that train stopped on those crossings, no cars can cross that crossing because the train's blocking it.
Right.
What happens in these situations, the conductor, if he needs to make a separation in the train to allow emergency vehicles through, he can make a separation right then, allow the emergency vehicles through, and they can do what they need to do. If there's one person, that's not going to happen unless the railroads send somebody out to that location. So it's just ridiculously unsafe and greedy.
And I got to be honest, it doesn't sound like you're taking one additional person off. In the big picture, I mean, we're talking about multi-billion-dollar industry here, that it would save them that much money. I mean, it's like, you know, looking for, you know, change in the couch cushions. It seems like that to me. This seems punitive more than anything.
Well, it's more about that the railroads are dictated by Wall Street now. It's all about the operating ratio to create the highest profit margin as possible. And the way they're doing that, it used to be, let's think of it like a tree with a lot of fruit on it. And the railroads used to, and all those the fruit are customers and rail shippers. And the railroads used to harvest the entire tree. And there was profit in all of the fruit. Some fruit was higher profit margin than others. So what the railroads have done now is decided, well, we're only gonna pick the fruit that has a really high profit margin, and we're just going to let the rest of it go, so that their operating ratio is increased, so they can show making more money by doing less. So it's basically doing less with less. And the shippers have a big problem with the greed that's happening because of Wall Street, as well as us.
Yeah.
And safety has been thrown to the wayside.
No,
they want to get rid of all the people doing inspections. They want to get rid of all the people doing track maintenance. They want to get rid of the people that do air tests and brake tests on the trains. It's really getting to a dangerous point. And if Trump had another 4 years, I'm afraid for the situation that America would be in the next coming years.
No, I'm with you. And, you know, as I'm looking at what happened in Texas, again, when you take regulations away, you let corporate America follow their natural path to lining their pockets at the expense of the rest of us, there's nothing but bad down the road. And that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, because I remember when I was a kid, you know, this is going back late 70s, early 80s, we used to spend a lot of time hopping the trains. We'd take it from Cleveland out to Bellevue, Ohio. We'd do all kinds of things on the trains. But there were a bunch of people that worked on those. I remember there were two guys sitting in the caboose. I don't even know if they have cabooses anymore. So we're down to two now? Because I remember there used to be several. What happened to whittling that down?
Well, it's all been because of technology, and it's all about technology. And the railroads don't look at technology as a way to make the railroads safer. They look at technology as a way to eliminate crew members. I'm a fifth generation railroader. So my family has been working for the railroad over 100 years, and I've seen these changes come. And for instance, you mentioned the caboose. The caboose was, they got rid of the caboose when they invented something called an end of train device. So they wanted to take those crew members off the rear of the train. They have an electronic device that can be administered from the engine that would put the train in emergency from the rear. One of the reasons you had crew members on the rear is if there was a problem with putting the train into emergency and they couldn't do it from the head end, you could do it from the rear end because you had people back there that could put the train in emergency. So they created this end of train device that replaced the caboose. That was in 1985. Those end of train devices fail every single day on the railroad. We had two fatalities last year because of a failure of an end of train device. So end of train devices didn't make the railroad safer. They just made it with less people, which has been the goal all along. They've gone from five people on a crew down to two, and they want to go to zero. And they're crying that they have to do this or they won't be profitable at a time when they're making more profit than they have ever made in the history of the world.
You know, it just goes back to that question, you know, how much is enough? And I remember the CEO of Caterpillar saying, it's never enough. I want more. I always want more. And this is another example that it's never enough. And what sadly ends up happening, as we've been discussing, we're the ones who end up bearing the cost of the external costs of more accidents, of more fatalities, of all of the things that come because of this. So the question that I come back to is, yeah, this is good. It's a good start. I'm glad the Ninth Circuit made the right decision. About time. How do we make sure that this doesn't continue to be an issue? Because I remember hearing about it back in 2013. This has not gone away, and I fear that it's not going to go away, you know, now. How do we make sure it goes away? We make sure that our trains are safe, our transportation networks are safe, and the transportation workers are safe.
Well, elections matter. And because of Joe Biden getting elected, we can put the brakes on a lot of this horrible stuff. The deregulation attitude that everyone's had, there's been such a narrative that regulation bad. We need businesses to make tons of money. They don't need oversight. I mean, look what happened in the airline industry with the FAA and Boeing. I mean, that's what happens when you let these industries self-regulate. You have problems like the 737 MAX. It's the same in the railroad. Now, if you let the railroad self-regulate, you're going to have people dying. We have a code of federal regulations for railroad that oversees regulatory issues with railroads. It's over 1,000 pages. And those regulations were written in blood. Every one of those regulations came about because people died because of bad behavior by the railroads. If you trust the railroads to do the right thing, they won't. We have a 150-year history proving that.
Now, that's an excellent point.
Now with the Biden administration and having adults in the room again, we're working very hard at rolling back a lot of the waivers that were granted. The Federal Railroad Administration under Ron Bottori, a former CEO for a railroad, they were rolling back and granting waivers to all the railroads whenever they asked. Oh, yeah, you don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to do that anymore. All about saving the railroads money and with no interest to safety. And now we have people back in the FRA, thanks to Joe Biden's victory, who care about safety again.
No, that's an incredible thing. But I want to go back to something you said a second ago, that every one of those pages of regulations were printed with people's blood. You know, because we hear an awful lot from the Republicans about, you know, job killing regulations. I hear it all the time. Job killing regulations. Got to get rid of those job killing regulations. But we don't hear an awful lot about when someone gets killed and it's because they've taken away those protections. And I'm glad you brought that up because I think people need to understand that there's a reason these regulations were put into place in the first place. And that's because something bad happened.
Oh, yeah. And the unions, you know, the rail unions were formed because of the bad behavior, because of safety. We were into safety long before we were into collective bargaining of taking care of our people, because the railroads wouldn't. It used to be if you got injured, you were fired right before that injury happened. And it's all about having no liability and no accountability to their employees. It's really sad. And the term being railroaded has been around for a long time. It's a derogatory term, and it was well earned by the railroads. Nobody says you got railroaded if something good happens.
That's a good
point. That's across the board.
You know, but I'm glad you brought that up as well, because one of the things that what's happened to our society is we stopped talking about that history. We stopped talking about how bad things were and how it was unions fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions, how it was fighting for good regulation and government, how it was fighting the good fight against corporate America to make them do the right thing that provided the things that we take for granted today.
You're exactly right. And I think that we're going to get back on that track and working towards that going forward. I mean, we had the Rail Safety Advisory Committee, which for the last 25 years has been the carriers and labor and the regulatory agencies working together to craft valuable regulation. If the railroad was going to talk about crew staffing, get all the players in the room, work it out, and come up with a solution. That stopped happening as soon as Trump was elected. They completely disbanded it. They let the charter run out, and then they wanted to reinstate it at a much watered down version. So this deregulation that Trump was on was very harmful to the safety of American railroads.
No, we got a lot of work to do. I hope people will check out your website, fightfortwopersoncrews.com. That's fightfortwopersoncrews.com. We'll get links out on social media how folks can take a look at that. But I wanted to ask you, back in 2020, there was a piece of legislation introduced in the Senate, the Safe Freight Act, Senate Bill 1979. Is that going to be reintroduced here in this session?
Well, actually, the two-person crew bill, which we've been running since Lac-Mégantic happened, that got passed out of the House in H.R. 2, the infrastructure bill that was passed and sent over to the Senate. Of course, Mitch McConnell has done absolutely nothing with it. And we're very hopeful and optimistic that that language will remain in the base bill for the infrastructure package. There was a rail safety title in HR 2 that covered a lot of the things that we've been working on for a number of years. So that's already passed the House. And now that we have a Democrats in charge of the Senate, we feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, because we do need massive infrastructure investment. And interestingly enough, rail gets the best grades from the American Society of Civil Engineers. They get a B grade. So good on you guys for fighting to make sure that infrastructure is well kept. But we can always do much better by making sure that we don't have the kind of tragedies that you were talking about, because we don't have cabooses anymore.
Right. And it's not just the freight rail. I mean, in passenger rail, this is a little bit off a topic, but it's still relevant. When we had the insurgency in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, a lot of those insurgents or domestic terrorists, whatever you want to call it, they traveled to D.C. on passenger rail, on Amtrak and on the MARC, and they were unruly. They wouldn't wear masks. They were belligerent to the other passengers and the crew members. They refused to get off the train when told to. There wasn't enough security to deal with them. And one of them was got off the train, was searched, and had a machete in his backpack. So I'm very confident that there were a lot of weapons on Amtrak. Jeez. And TSA has jurisdiction over Amtrak, and we want to see TSA have a presence at Amtrak. And that way they would have access to the don't fly list, and anybody who's on a don't fly list shouldn't be riding a train either. So we've got a lot of work to do on freight and passenger, and it's going to be very busy the next few years.
And I hope you'll come back and share with us all of those things. Greg, I appreciate you taking some time sharing these thoughts with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Hines, National Legislative Director for the Smart Union, the good folks at the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transit Workers. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.